Good morning, everyone. Thank you for coming. I call the House Fraud Prevention and State Agency Oversight Committee to order. We have a quorum, and today the purpose of the hearing is to talk with the Secretary of State and his team about how we can understand and prevent election fraud. There was a case this summer that we will get into where there were convictions for fraudulent voter registration. But first, before we do that, we are going to approve the minutes of September 17th. Representative Vice Chair Anderson, have you had a chance to review the minutes?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have, and I move approval.
Vice Chair Anderson moves approval. Any discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Minutes are approved. All right. So for the order of business, we're going to hear from Bill Glahn from Center of the American Experiment about the two cases, and then the secretary is due to arrive at 10:45, and then he and his team will be invited to join us at the witness table. So with that, Mr. Glahn, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Madam Chair, can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Thank you. He's on Zoom for anyone wondering what's going on here.
Okay. Bill Glahn with the, I'm a policy fellow with Center of the American Experiment in Minnetonka, Minnesota.
So I think, Mr. Glahn, we'd like you to go over. You attended the hearings regarding the convictions for the voter registration fraud, and could you just go through a brief explanation of that for the public, and then we'll probably have questions for you.
Okay, as briefly as possible. So I attended as a observer, as a reporter, if you will, two court hearings over the summer, one each for two people who pled guilty to one count each of conspiracy to commit voter registration fraud. And in general, these two individuals, I believe at the time, were romantic partners living out of West St. Paul, and they were employed by a foundation as independent contractors. This foundation is named Annika Foundation, and to my knowledge, they have never been accused of any wrongdoing, or no direct employee has ever been accused of any wrongdoing related to voter fraud. But these two contractors, one was named Ronnie Williams. He's also known as Michael Gibson. And then his partner in this conspiracy is named Lorraine Combs. And they were found guilty through guilty pleas of this conspiracy to commit voter registration fraud. And we don't have so many details about exactly what the fraud was, but apparently they, through the Annika Foundation, submitted hundreds of falsified voter registration forms that were submitted to 10 counties around the state. We don't have a list of which counties received the fake voter registration forms, other than the Carver County was mentioned by name in the course of these proceedings. And Lorraine Combs, for her part, she seems to be the junior partner in this conspiracy. She admitted to preparing more than 500 fake voter registration forms. And Ronnie Williams, who appears to be the senior partner in this, also prepared voter registration forms himself that were submitted to these counties. They invented names, identifying information such as dates of birth, social security numbers, addresses. They were paid by the foundation for these voter registration forms. It's not known how much they were paid by the foundation to prepare these, but it is believed that they were all faked. The information contained in the forms were did not correspond to any real person, real voter. They were submitted to, as I said, some 10 or more county election offices, and this was in the 2021-2022 election cycle. So not this past cycle, but the cycle before. And apparently this came to the attention of authorities, and eventually the FBI conducted an investigation. And then sometime in late 2024, these two individuals admitted to authorities that they had in fact committed this crime, that they had in fact engaged in this rather large voter fraud effort. And then over the summer, they came in individually. They were indicted individually, well, not indicted. They were charged individually, and they had their own individual hearings where they pled guilty. Neither has been sentenced yet. Ms. Combs is scheduled to be sentenced at the end of this month. And the sentencing guidelines for her, because she doesn't have a past criminal history, range from as low as 0 prison time to 6 months in prison. Mr. Williams' criminal history is much more complicated. Lawyers are still arguing over what the appropriate punishment for his guilty plea would be, the range being from 6 months all the way up to 30 months, 30 months. The maximum penalty for this crime is up to 5 years of imprisonment. And Mr. Williams' sentencing has not been scheduled yet, but it's believed that it'll take place sometime next month.
Thank you, Mr. Glahn. So I just had a couple of questions, and I'm sure if my colleagues do, they will join us. So in the indictment or in the charging documents, the 10 counties were never identified, and we will also be checking with the secretary when he comes forward. But do you have any knowledge other than the citing of Carver County in one of the documents, what 10, I've read in other news reports 15 counties. So is there any clarity on that you have found?
Nothing more than what you just stated. It was stated at least 10 being the minimum. And then Carver County was mentioned in the context that the U.S. Attorney's Office went out of their way to thank Carver County law enforcement authorities for this effort, for their efforts in supporting these prosecutions. By inference, you would imagine Carver County was one of the 10 or more counties involved.
Thank you. And my understanding is that this group had multiple independent contractors, but two were charged. Is that correct?
Correct. The two were charged. If you read the documents carefully, and I was in the back of the courtroom and heard the back and forth between the prosecution and the defense. There were unnamed others who served as intermediaries or other roles between Mr. Williams and Ms. Combs and the foundation itself. So there were other individuals who you would infer from the context were not employees of Anakin Foundation that somehow played a role in the conspiracy, but these individuals were never named or charged.
Thank you. And that was one of my questions, because it says that the two people that were indicted or charged were then giving the fraudulent voter registrations to people at the foundation, and then it was the foundation themselves that submitted them to the different counties. Is that your understanding?
I would just make a very slight, add a little bit of nuance to that. It sounded like there were registration forms that were submitted directly by the conspirators to the foundation, and perhaps others or more that were submitted indirectly through these intermediaries to the foundation.
Right, reading from...
And it's been made clear that the foundation itself was the entity or people working for the foundation submitted it to the counties. So the conspirators never dealt directly with the counties.
Right. So my understanding, just to clarify the chain, and obviously I'll ask the secretary staff this too, so you guys can be ready. But in the document, it says that the charged individual would provide the completed forms to the foundation through its agents, and then the foundation through its agents would submit these false voter registration applications to county election officials across the state. So the foundation was never charged. We don't know who these agents were, but this group clearly was defrauded by the individuals submitting the false applications. But then there doesn't seem to be a check, which is our role as the committee, to find how we can provide better oversight. There doesn't seem to be a check when this group submitted the fraudulent applications. So I don't know where that breakdown comes in, but clearly the foundation received the fraudulent applications, hundreds, up to 500 or more, And then they were submitted to the foundation, and then the foundation submitted it to the county election offices. So there's more to understand in this case than I think is in the charging documents. And certainly we look forward to having more of that conversation of how this happened. So that's the end of my questions. Members, anybody else have a question, or should we move on to the secretary? Oh, Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Glahn, in your observation of the hearing, did you witness any discussion regarding why this prosecution was coming from the federal level as opposed to being pursued locally by county attorneys?
Madam Chair, Representative Hudson, I'd have to say no. Again, it's interesting as an observer to many, many of these sort of hearings where somebody's entering a guilty plea. It tends to be the case that prosecutors and the defense introduce just enough information to convince the judge that the defendant is in fact guilty of the crime they're pleading guilty to. They don't get to a lot of backstory or a lot of extraneous information. It's very narrowly tailored to a very specific purpose. So it's not clear why the FBI got involved. It is clear they were involved because they stated in open court that each of these two individuals who were convicted had admitted their culpability to the FBI. But how the FBI got involved as opposed to the Attorney General or the Secretary of State's office or some state or county authority is unclear. There were, I'm sure, through Congress or the U.S. Senate, I can't recall quite the batting order of the 2022 cycle, but there was a federal election in the fall of 2022. There were state and local elections, too. So I imagine there were any number of other ordinances and state laws that were also broken. But this was taken up by the feds.
Yes, Chair Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Lead Pinto for this committee, though I appreciate it. And just a small thing for Mr. Glahn. I noticed the thanks from the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Carver County Sheriff's Office, which is terrific. I also noted that the U.S. Attorney's Office specifically thanked the Office of the Secretary of State as well. And just, I guess, want to see if you have comment on that. I just want to make sure to note that not only Carver County Sheriff's Office, but actually our Secretary of State received specific thanks from the U.S. Attorney's Office for the office's work regarding this.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Mr. Glahn.
Representative Pinto, all that's correct. I just didn't bring that up because I understood I would be followed by the Secretary of State's office, who can better speak to their own role in the process.
Thank you. All right. Thank you, Mr. Glahn. We appreciate your testimony. Now we would like to hear from Secretary of State Simon and his team. Welcome to the committee. Good morning, Secretary Simon. Please state your name for the record. We appreciate you joining us today.
Thank you. Steve Simon, Minnesota Secretary of State. Good morning, Madam Chair and members. It's an honor to be with you. Thank you for the opportunity. The invitation to appear here today was a request to talk about a particular episode that made headlines last June. It's a story really with two parts. The first part is how Minnesota's election system, featuring dedicated election officials in just over a dozen counties in Minnesota, plus staff from our office, worked successfully to prevent would-be fraudsters from harming Minnesota's election system with false voter registrations. The second part is how our office worked with state and federal law enforcement to ensure that the individuals submitting these false voter registrations were brought to justice. And I just want to be clear here that, as you know, this is a case about individuals who conspired to submit false voter registration applications. This is not a case about fraudulent votes. And this is ultimately a case of the system working to detect these applications so they could be appropriately challenged and referred to law enforcement for prosecution and conviction. I'm here with Minnesota State Elections Director Paul Linnell, as well as with Government Relations Director Nicole Freeman and Deputy Secretary of State Julie Strother. I'm going to turn the microphone over to Mr. Linnell in just a minute to give an overview of how the system worked to detect these fake applications, how our office and county partners responded, and how county and state election officials helped the FBI in their investigation over a period of more than 2 years. But before I do that, I just want to make sure that members of this committee know that I personally and the staff from our office are always available to meet with you and your staff to answer any questions that you have about our election system. This is an offer, as some know, that I make regularly to members of the Elections Committee and their staff, but I want to make sure to extend the offer to this committee and staff as well. So if members and staff don't already have my personal cell phone number, I will make sure that you get it. You can call me or text me anytime. And the follow-up, by the way, doesn't just have to be in your offices. As Representatives Hudson and Greenman and others know, I'm happy to meet in your community and do voter education events as well. So if there are questions or concerns after this presentation, this afternoon, tomorrow, next week, whenever, or if you want to know more about an unrelated election issue, please don't hesitate to reach out to me personally or to our office. Now I'm going to hand the microphone over to Mr. Linnell, because to appreciate how these registrations were caught does require an understanding of the various safeguards in Minnesota's voter registration system. Now, there are some members of this committee who now serve or have served on the Elections Committee, but many have not. So I've asked Mr. Linnell to give just a brief overview of how the state's voter registration works, basically along with the checks contained within the system. Mr. Linnell will then explain how the false voter registrations in this particular case were flagged and how staff from the Office of Secretary of State and county election officials responded and coordinated with law enforcement to ensure that the individuals attempting to perpetrate this fraud were caught and charged. Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I'll yield with your permission to Mr. Linnell.
Thank you, Secretary Simon. We hope you will stay as well to answer some questions. And welcome to the committee, Mr. Linnell. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning. My name is Paul Linnell, and I am the Director of Elections with the Office of the Secretary of State. I've been with the office since 2022 and in my current role going back to July of last year. Before coming to the office, I served as the elections lead in Anoka County. So for my presentation this morning, I'd like to start by providing an overview of how the voter registration and verification process works in Minnesota. Then I will cover how election officials in Minnesota work throughout the year to ensure that our voter rolls are accurate and up to date. As requested by the committee, I'll also include details about the Electronic Registration Information Center, or ERIC, a multi-state member-led organization that assists with voter list maintenance. Then I'll briefly talk through what happens after Election Day to process Election Day registrations and enter voting history. And finally, I'll spend some time walking through the series of events that led to two individuals pleading guilty to charges of conspiracy to commit voter registration fraud earlier this year. To start, I'll provide a brief summary of the roles and responsibilities for administering voter registration in Minnesota. The Secretary of State serves as Minnesota's chief election official. Among the duties for the Office of the Secretary of State is the responsibility for defining, maintaining, and administering the statewide voter registration system, or SVRS. The Elections Division of the office includes a team of state program administrators and IT staff that support the voter registration system and several other related tools, including public-facing voter tools like online voter registration and the polling place finder. The office is also responsible for developing forms for use in elections, including the voter registration application and preparing and publishing information about elections. The office also has responsibility for training and certifying county elections officials. It is the county auditor that serves as the chief registrar of voters and the custodian of official voter registration records in each county. This is an elected position in some counties and appointed in others. In some counties, especially those with large numbers of registered voters, elections responsibilities are delegated to an elections director or manager. In the vast majority of counties, elections and voter registration is just one of the many responsibilities for the county auditor. Other duties may include property records, taxation, licensing, finance, and more. County elections officials are responsible for carrying out most functions related to voter registration, including the entry of new voter registration applications or updating existing records in the statewide voter registration system. The county auditor is then responsible for training and certifying municipal clerks on their election administration responsibilities and also training election judges. Municipal clerks' elections responsibilities largely revolve around serving as the filing officer for their jurisdiction's offices, creating precinct boundaries, and designating election day polling places and recruiting and employing election judges. Several municipalities, primarily larger cities, also administer absentee voting, including facilitating election day registration for in-person absentee voters. At the polling place on election day, election judges are responsible for managing the polling place rosters and administering the election day registration process for voters that are not yet registered or need to update their information on election day. However, all of the actual entry and processing of voter registration applications is managed at the county level. Voter registration in Minnesota is limited to only those who meet the eligibility criteria to register and vote. One must be a U.S. citizen and must be at least 16 years old to submit a voter registration application. Those who are not yet 18 are set to a pending status until their 18th birthday when their voter record becomes active. Registrants must have been a resident of Minnesota for at least 20 days prior to registering. Those who are incarcerated for a felony conviction cannot register to vote while they're incarcerated. And individuals are not eligible to register if a court has taken away their right to vote as part of a guardianship or if they've been found legally incompetent. At the time of registration, voters affirm their eligibility to vote through the signing of a certification statement detailing all of these eligibility requirements and a statement that defines the penalties for falsifying information on a voter registration form. All voter registration applications must undergo a two-step verification process. The first part of this process is to confirm that the voter is who they say they are. This is done by matching data provided on their application to a government database. Most matching takes place behind the scenes when the record is checked against the Department of Public Safety database. For voter registrations that come from driver and vehicle services, those records have already been verified as a match since the record is on file with DPS. Similarly, any registration applications that are submitted through the online voter registration application are only passed along for registration if the information provided on that application form can be matched against data in the DPS or Social Security Administration database. For voters that are registering using a paper application, the data that's provided on that form is entered into SVRS by the county and then sent to DPS to be verified. If there's a match, then the voter status in the system will change from to be verified to verified. If there's not an exact match to one in the DPS database, but there are potential matches, those potential matches are queued for the county to review and determine whether the voter record and the DPS record are the same person. A common example of a situation where there is an exact match, where there is not an exact match, is when someone has a hyphenated last name and does not exactly match between the two databases. This would require a manual review to determine that the record corresponds to the same person. There also may be cases of data entry errors or instances where the information provided on the voter registration application may not have been clearly written. Some common data entry issues may include transposing ID numbers or handwriting, where a 9 may look like a 4. When the record is returned for further review, it provides the county election official an opportunity to review that data and confirm whether anything may have been entered incorrectly. If the record cannot be verified through DPS, and the applicant has provided the last 4 digits of their Social Security number, then their information is sent to the SSA database for verification. If there's not a match, the county election official must use other methods to attempt to verify the voter's identity. This may include record searches, contact by mail, phone, or email. There's a 10-day window for counties to review those records that cannot be matched. And for any records that cannot be verified, the registration is flagged as incomplete. Here's a diagram that shows the workflow, what I just described, for any new record or an update to an existing voter record. As noted on the previous slide, all voters start with sending their data through the DPS database to determine if there is a match with an existing record. Additional review then takes place for cases where there's not an exact match, but potential matches are identified. If there's not a match with the DPS record and we have the last 4 of the Social Security number, it's sent to that SSA database for review. SSA only returns the record as a match if there's an exact match with the data that is provided. So again, for that voter with the hyphenated name, it would not be returned as a match if there are discrepancies between how the name is listed. Finally, if a record cannot be verified through DPS or the SSA, it is reviewed by the county auditor, and if it cannot be verified, it's marked in the system as incomplete. For any records that are marked as incomplete, a notice is queued in the statewide voter registration system for the county to mail to the registrant. The content of that notice will vary depending on how the voter applied to be registered and whether they are a first-time voter. As required by federal law, incomplete registrations for first-time voters that are registering by mail and who have not voted in a federal election must either complete their registration with the county auditor before the election or provide an acceptable identification document when arriving to vote on election day. These registrants will be marked with a CID designation on the polling place roster and must provide ID to the election judge before they are allowed to vote. A voucher cannot be used to clear the CID requirement for these voters. It must be an acceptable photo ID. All other incomplete registrations are marked as challenged, unverifiable, and they must clear the challenge to affirm their eligibility before being permitted to vote. If there's any evidence that a voter is not eligible to vote, that must be referred to the county attorney for investigation.
Pardon me, Mr. Linnell, can I just ask a question there while I'm thinking of it? Thank you. So you said that if it's flagged as CID, they must provide an acceptable photo ID. So in these cases, a utility bill is not sufficient?
Madam Chair, in those cases, it would be the photo ID that's used in combination with a utility bill as an acceptable proof of residence document for election day registration purposes. So the distinction is that the vouching process, which is acceptable for registering to vote on election day, would not be applicable for this group of incomplete registrants who are marked on the roster as CID.
Thank you. So just to drill down one more, it must include a photo ID of some type.
Correct.
Thank you. And just a second, Vice Chair Anderson. But this is for people who've never voted in federal elections before. And we'll talk about the next case where they may have been inactive next, I'm assuming.
Madam Chair, that's correct. The requirement for marking these records as CID on the roster is a federal requirement that applies just to first-time voters who have not yet voted in a federal election. If it's not a first-time registrant, if it's an update to a registration, or if there's other ways in which they've registered to vote, but it still comes back as not being able to be verified, they are marked as challenged, unverifiable in the system.
Perfect. Thank you. Vice Chair Anderson.
Thank you. So we give driver's licenses to anyone here. You don't have to be a citizen. You don't have to, which is a photo ID. So if someone comes in, they register, they have the driver's license, but they have an incorrect social or no social or whatever. So then they become incomplete. But if they walk in to vote with their driver's license, does that make them all of a sudden now okay?
Mr. Linnell.
Madam Chair, so the designation on the roster for someone whose registration had been incomplete, if they present the election judge with that acceptable identification document, that would clear the challenge from the roster and they would be permitted to cast a ballot.
Anderson?
Well, okay. There's your problem, potentially. So, thank you.
So just to clarify, someone who is not a citizen but presents a driver's license at that point in the process could be permitted to vote?
Madam Chair, at the time of registration, as well as at the time of submitting a ballot, every voter is signing the attestation affirming their eligibility to vote, including that they meet all eligibility requirements, that they are a U.S. citizen. If it's determined then that the voter was not, in fact, eligible to vote, that information would be provided to the county attorney for investigation and potential prosecution.
Vice Chair Anderson.
Madam Chair, but if they sign and they say they're eligible to vote and they walk in with a driver's license, even though they're not, because we give driver's licenses to anyone in the state, they can vote. if they sign that they're eligible.
Mr. Linnell.
Madam Chair, again, in this scenario where we're talking about a record that has been flagged for the CID requirement, that is the requirement that they must clear under federal law in order to be allowed to vote. It doesn't contemplate a hypothetical where someone is not otherwise eligible to vote. It's to affirm their identity as the voter. It's that they are who they say they are, that it's a match against, again, one of the databases. Ideally, that's done through the number matching with the DPS database or with the Social Security Administration. It is the other elements of being eligible to vote that the voter is attesting to and certifying at the time that they're registering and when they are casting a ballot.
Thank you. So the answer to my question is yes. Under that scenario, someone could, they get their driver's license, again, because we give them to anybody here. They register to vote. It doesn't match with the Social Security number, so they're flagged, but they come in as long as they have an ID, which is that driver's license, and they sign that they're, you know, eligible to vote, they can vote. And they're then no longer flagged. They're on the system. Is that correct?
Mr. Linnell.
Madam Chair, if I could add the, and maybe stepping back from those that are flagged as CID on the roster, for anyone that's presenting documentation to register to vote, that is affirmation of their identity. The driver's license has not been used as proof of citizenship for the purposes of registering to vote. It's affirming that they are who they say they are. So
right.
In any of these cases where someone were to cast a ballot if they were ineligible to vote, there are also reports that are generated post-election for voters that are challenged that counties will run to show status of voters that had been updated due to the fact that they've now cast a ballot that can be reviewed and referred to the county attorney.
Okay, so the answer is yes to my question. You haven't said it, but is that correct? The answer was...
Secretary Simon.
If I could intervene here, and if I could zoom out a little bit... I just want to make clear that this is not a new issue for Minnesota. For over 100 years, people who have had not only driver's licenses but other form of ID that can be used in an election that does not distinguish between a citizen and a non-citizen. So my mother is a good example. My mother, for over 30 years, was a green card holder. She was driving around Minnesota for decades with a valid driver's license that could have, I suppose, been used for voting. Although the instances of that are just vanishingly rare, it almost never, ever happens. There have been some recent studies about that are Minnesota specifics. But I would just draw your attention to the fact that we have other IDs, not just driver's licenses, that we, I guess, give to everyone that do not make a distinction between citizenship and non. For example, a student ID. No student ID that I've ever seen from any college or university has a marking that shows whether someone's a citizen or not, or a military ID. There is no military ID that I've ever seen that shows a demarcation about whether someone's a citizen or not. So I just wanted us to put this in perspective. Reasonable people in this room can have a different idea about how we ought to do things. That's perfectly fair. But I just want to give a little bit of context that this is not new. As with my mother, this is a decades-old, I would say a century-old issue in Minnesota.
Thank you. Follow-up. Thank you. All right. Mr. Linnell, so sorry to have derailed you here. We look forward to you continuing.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So moving ahead to the second half of that verification process when one registers to vote, which is to confirm that the voter lives where they say they live. So after being registered, a postal verification card, or PVC, is sent to the voter's residential address as a non-forwardable mailing. If the mailing is delivered, the address is confirmed and no further action is taken. If the mailing is returned to the county elections office as undeliverable, the voter record then must be challenged. A second card is then sent after 60 days, and if that card is returned, the voter record is inactivated. There are many reasons why a PVC may be returned, which include incomplete information. For example, if the address provided did not include the apartment unit number for the voter or the voter is temporarily away from their home address. If the card is returned with a forwarding address, there are procedures in place for how to handle that record. Those include updating the address in the voter's record if the address is within the county, providing the card to another Minnesota county to update the record if the voter's moved to another county in the state, or triggering the process to inactivate the voter record if data indicates that the voter has moved out of state. Additional procedures are required for postal verification cards that are returned for individuals registering on Election Day that I'll touch on later.
I'm sorry, I have one more question. Yeah. So I'm curious about this because this happened in my household. So we received a voter absentee application form for the previous owners of my home, who I happen to know. And I returned it. I, the homeowner, got it. And I did not fill it out. I returned it and said, you know, no longer here, whatever, I put on the envelope and stuck it back in the mailbox. So is it incumbent on the people living in the residence when they get those things to return it if it's not caught in the mail system already? And the example I want to bring up is there was a case last year where, indeed, a woman got in Itasca County a ballot for her mother who had died, and she filled it out. So is it incumbent on the people who get these things in their home to return it, or what is the process for making sure that all this postal verification is rock solid? Thank you.
Madam Chair, thank you for the question. There are the technical ways in which the card is flagged as non-forwardable. So if the USPS cannot deliver it, it will be returned, and they'll often have the stickers on it indicating the reason why the card was returned. But certainly if a card is delivered to a residence and the information does not correspond to who is living there, we would encourage the homeowner, the resident, to reach out to the county elections office, provide them with information about the card they received. It's possible that it was delivered to the wrong address, or to your point, if it was a previous resident and the information may be out of date, to provide that to the county elections office so they can take a look at that record and determine if any updates may need to be made based on that information. I will talk a little bit about the specific case that you mentioned of how Minnesota counties do update records based on information that's received from the Department of Health to mark records as deceased in the system, but there are times it's not always going to be a real-time update. So if there is a lag in data, you may find an opportunity like that where a postal verification card is sent, or there's something that's sent that's not corresponding to who currently resides at the address. It's, I think, as close as possible based on the list maintenance procedures that counties are doing on a daily basis. But that would be, I think, effective use of the system if that information is provided to the county. So the more they have, the more accurate and up-to-date the records can be.
Thank you.
Which is a great segue into the next slide. So after a voter is added into the system, the record is now subject to the constant checks that ensure their data remains up to date. The OSS receives data from a number of agencies to facilitate these updates. The Department of Corrections shares a file each month with the names of all individuals that are currently incarcerated for a felony offense. Names that match with a registered voter are provided in a report to the county to be challenged. Once an individual is released from incarceration, the records are flagged for the county to remove the challenge from the record. And any instances where it appears that an individual may have voted while incarcerated are also referred to the county attorney for review and investigation. The Department of Health provides a monthly file with names of those who have died in Minnesota. Names from that file that match with a record in SVRS are shared with counties to review the data and mark the records as deceased. Counties also often review obituaries and receive and process reports filed with their offices, certifying that a voter has passed away, and update records accordingly. The Department of Public Safety provides a monthly file with names of non-citizens in Minnesota on a temporary visa. If there is a match with a registered voter, that data is provided to the county to challenge the record and refer to the county attorney for investigation. The state court administrator also regularly provides information on legal name changes, as well as court orders related to guardianship or incompetence where one's voting rights have been removed or restored. Minnesota is also a member of the Electronic Registration Information Center, or ERIC, that helps to facilitate voter list maintenance that I'll talk a little bit more about shortly. Each January, the office also conducts an annual list maintenance process as required by law. Any records that do not have active voting, that do not have voting activity or an update to the record over the preceding 4 years are changed to a status of inactive. Voters who are inactivated are required to re-register before they're eligible to vote in a future election. This serves as a routine check to inactivate any dormant records that may not have been updated through the regular list maintenance procedures. When a voter record is added into SVRS, a search is also conducted against the database of existing active and inactive records to ensure a record does not already exist for the voter. Election officials can view any potential matching records and select the existing record to be updated if there is a match. If a new record is being entered, but there's already one with certain matching information, the system will flag that as a potential match and prompt the county to undertake additional review before creating the voter record. In rare instances, a new record may be added with data that does not match the already existing voter record, resulting in a duplicate record being created. SVRS has a series of reports that flag these potential duplicate voter records for review, and matches that are confirmed are then merged to ensure that there is only one voter record for each voter.
Vice Chair Anderson.
Thank you. So you do this maintenance yearly. So do you, so back to the situation that we were talking about earlier, where you have someone that has a driver's license, which they can get anywhere, no matter who they are, in the state, and they go and they vote or they register. It's flagged as needs an ID. They won't go in. They use their ID. They sign. Do you go back and look at the Social Security number and the reason that that was not matching originally? Do you go back and you compare that to the Social Security database regularly, at least for, well, everyone, but certainly for people where it didn't match in the first place? Do you do that?
Mr. Linnell.
Madam Chair, so for any record that is flagged as failed verification, and specifically to the Social Security Administration database, I would say that operates somewhat as a black box. If we get a matching record to confirm that it is verified against the Social Security database, it comes back to confirm that there's a match. We don't have a lens into that database to see what it is that may be causing the record not to match, whether it's a transposed number, whether it's a issue with the last name not matching exactly, any number of reasons where it's a genuine valid voter registration, but it's coming back from the SSA showing that it can't be verified with that information. But for any record that's submitted at the time that that verification cannot be confirmed, that's where that additional review by the county elections office is taking place to make sure that that record then gets flagged and challenged in the system. And as I touched on briefly, there are a series of reports that are generated after each election to show any records that may have been challenged and updated as a result of voting in that election that are reviewed, and if there's any discrepancies there or if an unverified voter has cast a ballot, that may be referred on to the county attorney for investigation.
Vice Chair Anderson.
Yeah, thank you. So no, you don't look after the facts. So in this case, you wouldn't take the list of people who have come in who originally their socials didn't match. They are now active because they brought their photo ID in. But you don't go after the fact and take a look and see if it matches, you know, do anything with the Social Security database to recheck these folks after the fact. And then finally, once they voted, are there ballots, let's say nobody challenges them at the polls, once they voted, are there, you know, their vote counts, right? Whether or not they're...
Madam Chair, as I mentioned, there's not anything more that we can do to cross-reference against the Social Security database to determine the reason why there may not have been a match in that record. But if that record has cast a ballot, those are reports that county elections offices are running after each election for voters that have had their status updated from challenged to active. And if there's a case that needs to be investigated further, the county attorney would do that work to determine whether it was an invalid ballot that may have been cast.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Please proceed.
All right. So as noted previously, Minnesota is one of the 25 states plus Washington, D.C. that are members of the Electronic Registration Information Center, or ERIC. Minnesota joined ERIC in 2014 following a legislative change that allows for data sharing with an organization that is governed exclusively by a group of states to maintain voter registration records. As was just outlined, voter rolls are constantly changing, with voters being added and removed from the rolls. Roughly 10% of Americans move each year on average, but most of those individuals do not notify their prior county or state once they've moved. Eric's reports help to identify those voters who have moved, both within Minnesota and out of the state, as well as those who may have changed their name or passed away, and ensure that their voter registration is updated. As part of the membership agreement, members are required to submit their state voter registration data and driver's license and identification data to Eric at least once every 60 days. Minnesota submits this data on a monthly basis. That data is always sent via secure encrypted transmission, and sensitive personal identifying information like date of birth, driver's license number, or social security number is converted into a string of random characters as part of cryptographic hashing that is applied for data that is transmitted. I'll talk a little bit more about data security with Eric on a subsequent slide. The state data that is provided to Eric is compared against data from all other member states, along with other sources like the Social Security Death Master File, to create several list maintenance reports. Eric then returns these reports to states to review the identified potential matches. Once confirmed, these matches are provided to counties to make the appropriate update to the identified voter records. So the reports that are listed on this slide are those that Minnesota receives back from Eric to assist with the voter list maintenance process. Again, Minnesota receives these reports at the maximum frequency, once per month, to keep our registered voter list as up-to-date as possible on an ongoing basis. First, the cross-state movers report identifies voters who appear to have moved from one Eric state to another by comparing registered voter data against motor vehicle data. A voter's name would appear on this report if they're registered to vote in Minnesota but subsequently applied for a driver's license or ID card in another Eric member state. Their appearance on this report would provide evidence that they have moved to another state and that their voter record should be updated to reflect this change. Once processed by the county, a postcard is mailed to the voter's new out-of-state address, informing them of the pending change and providing notice that their record in Minnesota will be inactivated. The card includes information for the voter to contact the county elections office within 21 days to reverse the change if they are retaining the former address as their address of residence. The in-state movers report provides information about those who have moved within the state by comparing Minnesota's voter rolls against the Department of Public Safety's data. So it functions similar to the out-of-state or cross-state movers report, but for those that have moved within the state. The duplicate report identifies potential duplicate registrations within the state, same state, by comparing voter registration data. This report functions similar to the duplicate voter reports that are available in SVRS and conducts additional data analysis to determine whether the state's voter registration records identify more than one registration that appears to be for the same person. Names that are identified on this report are provided to the county to review and determine if they apply to the same person, and if confirmed, the records are merged so that there is only a single record on file. The deceased report compares voter registration data against the Social Security death data, known as the Limited Access Death Master File, to identify any voters who may have passed away. Registered voters who appear to match a deceased individual are included on the report, and the data is provided to the county to mark the record as deceased. This provides national data on deaths and helps to identify registered Minnesota voters whose death may have not been reported through the State Department of Health. And finally, the National Change of Address Report identifies voters who have moved using change of address data from the USPS. This covers those who have submitted a change of address request for either an in-state move or an out-of-state move. This report then functions similar to the cross-state and in-state movers report, where records are updated accordingly and postcards are sent to the voter based on that change. To ensure the secure handling of data, Eric provides all member states with an application that's used to apply a cryptographic one-way hash to sensitive data elements before it's transmitted to Eric. Private data fields, including the driver's license or state ID number or any part of the social security number and date of birth, are converted into those random characters, which makes the data significantly more difficult for a potential hacker to utilize. Eric will only accept data files that have been hashed using this application to ensure that sensitive data is protected at the source before it is submitted to Eric. Once that data is hashed, it's securely transmitted using multiple rounds and types of encryption. This hashing process is applied a second time once Eric accepts the data file, ensuring that the hashed values are different and secure. Eric then utilizes matching software to compare the common fields across the submitted data to determine if those records refer to the same people, and then produces the reports that I mentioned to make available to member states for secure download once that matching is completed. Eric also has a robust member-approved information security management plan and regularly undertakes independent reviews of its data security practices. And then just briefly, before getting to the voter registration investigation, I want to walk through the steps that take place after each election, which I've touched on a bit in response to some of the questions raised. In the days and weeks after Election Day, counties are responsible for entering voting history data. This process involves scanning barcodes into SVRS for each voter record that cast a ballot on the paper rosters or by uploading electronic roster files to SVRS for counties that may be using electronic poll books. This data entry and review ensures that voting history is properly applied to every voter who cast a ballot at the election. This data entry must be completed within 42 days after Election Day, and counties must also enter voter registration applications for anyone that's registered on Election Day or as part of the absentee voting process. All voters who registered on Election Day are sent through the same verification process as voters who register prior to Election Day. There's some additional requirements that are specific to Election Day registrants. Counties are required to have processed a random sampling of at least 3% of all Election Day registrants within 10 days after Election Day. Counties have 42 days to enter all of their Election Day registration information, and our office is required to post data on our website detailing the progress for county data entry of registrations following each election. As an additional requirement, counties must document and report the number of postal verification cards that are returned for Election Day registrations and the reasons why those cards were returned. This report also requires identifying the total number of individuals for whom the county auditor does not receive satisfactory proof of an individual's eligibility to vote. In those instances, information must be immediately forwarded on to the county attorney for review. Data from the county's reports are collected by our office and compiled into a single report that is submitted annually to the legislature. So with that background on voter registration and verification, I'll now walk through the details surrounding the voter registration fraud case that our office was asked to discuss before the committee today. In the summer of 2022, a handful of counties began to identify anomalies with some paper voter registration applications. One county had reported a separate earlier batch that was received back in the fall of 2021. Among the discrepancies that were identified were similar-looking handwriting on applications and similar patterns with the manner in which the data was provided on the form. As the voter registrations were entered into the statewide voter registration system, records were not passing that process to identify and verify the identity of the applicant. In many instances, the postal verification cards that were mailed to the voter were returned as undeliverable, which resulted in the records being challenged and subsequently inactivated when a second postal verification card was returned. The pattern was noticeable enough for multiple counties to have referred the voter registrations for further review and investigation. One of those counties, which was named in the charging documents from the Department of Justice, was Carver County. Carver County election staff reported receiving two suspicious batches of voter registration applications in August and September of 2022, which had been forwarded to the county from the Office of the Secretary of State. This is a regular practice for our office when we receive voter registrations that are mailed to us, as the voter registration applications include our mailing address on the back of the form to be returned to our office. After they're received, mail staff at the office sort the applications by county and send to counties to be entered into SVRS. Within the second batch of applications, Carver County election staff identified discrepancies with addresses that were submitted as being non-residential properties. This led to further review by election staff and the identification of similar patterns with that group of previously submitted applications. At that time, the Carver County Elections Manager reached out to the Carver County Sheriff's Office to initiate an investigation into the suspicious applications. After reviewing the available information from the voter registration applications, outreach was made from Carver County to the FBI to assist with the investigation. In mid-October of 2022, The FBI special agent made contact with several other counties' elections offices and began to assess the scope of the issue. As part of this outreach, it was determined that similarly suspicious voter registration applications had been recently received by other counties and that at least one local investigation was also underway. Around this same time, the FBI special agent also reached out to our office to provide information from their contacts with counties. As soon as our office learned of this issue, we conducted individual outreach to the elections lead in all 87 counties. As part of this outreach, we shared that multiple counties had reported receiving suspicious voter registration applications and inquired as to whether their county may have received any applications that fit the same pattern. For any that responded affirmatively, guidance was provided to refer the applications for investigation if that had not already been done and to encourage outreach to the FBI. Reminders were also provided to counties regarding the appropriate steps to take as part of the data entry and verification process in SVRS. Through this outreach, we learned that voter records had not been created for many of the applicants due to fundamental deficiencies on the form, specifically several instances where addresses could not be identified as part of a valid address range. Counties create narrow address ranges within SVRS, which serves to limit data entry to only valid addresses. In mid-November of 2022, the Office of the Secretary of State received an additional batch of voter registration applications, with some that included characteristics that appeared to fit the pattern of anomalous registrations that had been previously identified by the counties. We immediately notified the FBI about these applications and were provided with detailed guidance for OSS staff to use gloves and minimize handling when reviewing and sorting the applications. Upon review, it was determined that the applications contained addresses that were spread across five counties. Our office again reached out directly to the elections lead in each of these five counties to advise that we had received potentially suspicious voter registration applications with addresses in their county. On guidance from the FBI, the voter registration applications were mailed directly to the election lead, and instructions were shared to use gloves when handling the forms and to keep them separated from any other voter registration applications or other documents. We reiterated that if a voter registration application included clearly false information, such as a non-existent address or invalid unit number, the registration should be considered deficient and that a voter record would not be created. And for any records that were entered but ultimately failed verification, to confirm that those were properly challenged in the system and flagged to local and federal law enforcement for further investigation. In the weeks that followed, the FBI special agent traveled to the counties to interview election staff and take possession of flagged documents and conduct forensic analysis. Our office also provided additional data to the FBI regarding the records in question, as well as clarification on applicable state laws and procedures that would help to inform their investigation. Over the following 2+ years, our office would have regular engagements with our FBI contacts as part of the office's overall election security preparedness and planning with federal and state partners. At these opportunities, we would inquire as to whether there were any updates or additional information that we might be able to provide, and we were told that the investigation was ongoing. Then on June 13th, 2025, the Department of Justice announced that two individuals had been charged with conspiracy to engage in voter registration fraud. According to the court documents, the individuals provided the fictitious names and information on Minnesota voter registration applications to an unnamed foundation. That foundation, in turn, submitted the applications to be processed by county election offices across Minnesota. In late June and early July, the two defendants both pled guilty to the charges filed against them. From the time that the office was first contacted by the FBI, we responded quickly and comprehensively to all requests for information. We also helped to facilitate coordination between the FBI and county elections offices across the state. We reached out directly to the elections leads in all 87 counties once the issue was brought to our attention to ensure that everyone had the same information and could be on the lookout if they were to end up receiving any suspicious applications in their county. Through this outreach, we were able to identify 13 counties that had flagged potentially suspicious voter registration applications and share that information with the FBI. In turn, this allowed us to pass along the FBI's guidance for safe handling procedures to those counties to help with the preservation of evidence. We also conducted a complete review in SVRS of all of the identified applications. Through this review, we were able to confirm that all records had been challenged and that the flagged records would have been required to complete additional steps in order to cast a ballot in any election. No ballots had been cast or even requested for any of the potentially suspicious records. As noted before, many of the records had never been entered into the system due to deficiencies on the applications, and others were subsequently inactivated based on returned postal verification cards. All of the counties that were involved played a pivotal role throughout the investigation. Carver County Elections and the Carver County Sheriff's Office, which was thanked for their work in the Department of Justice press release, played a critical part in being the first county to elevate the issue so that it could be addressed at a statewide level using the support of state and federal resources. Other impacted counties also acted swiftly in response to identifying these discrepancies, including starting local investigations within the county. County election officials conducted thorough reviews of all of the available information, including reviewing previously submitted batches of voter registration applications. They worked in concert with our office and federal law enforcement to respond quickly to all requests for information during the investigation. They followed the law and procedures to ensure that the records were properly reviewed and challenged. For the last several election cycles, election administrators have all preached the mantra of see something, say something when it comes to election security. As soon as this issue was identified, the proper referrals were made to dig into the discrepancies. Sounding the alarm early on allowed for our office to alert counties across the state to be on the lookout for similar activity in their county. It goes without saying that it is unacceptable that these individuals sought to manipulate Minnesota's voter registration system for their own gain. But thanks to the coordination and collaboration between law enforcement and election officials at the federal, state, and county level, their actions were identified, the records were flagged, no invalid votes were cast, and the perpetrators have been brought to justice. Thank you, Madam Chair. That concludes my presentation and would be happy to yield to any questions.
Thank you. I'm sure we have many. Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, both of you, Secretary Simon and your whole team, for giving us this comprehensive review of voter registration and the verification system. I think I'm the only person on the committee who is on the Elections and Local Government Committee and have been for the last my three terms in office, and so appreciate we get much more into detail in that committee, which is really where we spend our time. And I'm a little, I just wanted to make sure that the public understands, because I was a little confused by what Chair Robbins said. This seems to be a place where there are no checks. But it is actually those checks, which we heard both Mr. Glenn painstakingly recount the what was happening in court, as well as both of you talk about what led to the indictments and prosecutions. I would note to folks that in that MACO, the Association of County Officers who actually administer our elections in Minnesota, in the last line, described, I think, what is important and pretty much wraps up this, which says this outcome demonstrates that the system's checks and verifications worked as designed. So I appreciate that. And I think that this was a helpful and useful, place. What I will say is, what is frustrating is that we have an hour and a half that we have spent a valuable committee time. It's the only thing really happening officially in the House. And we are chasing what is the system working, which is great. I think it's great when we spend time on that. Feels like there's some manufactured, the issue of voter fraud, which we continue here. We know, and I will cite some statistics about how exceedingly rare that is. But the thing that is hard for me is what we're not doing in this committee for government oversight. I will say that the reason I was late is that I was upstairs in the House chamber with third graders from Annunciation, which is in my district, and which I think you all know suffered a horrible mass shooting 7 weeks ago. And I was with those folks thinking our leaders have been talking about gun violence prevention, and it feels like a committee on government oversight should also be thinking about how do we oversee the laws that potentially can stop these shootings and these weapons of war on our streets. I'll say that the district court found that there were two cases of voter fraud in 45 million ballots cast since 1979. That was in 2020. There were two children murdered in 4 minutes. And so when I think about the issues that we should be focusing on here, it seems to me the ones that are actually having impact in our communities. And let me talk about a couple of the things we could be talking about here as we talk about strategies. We saw last week the Star Tribune did a report on red flag laws of extremist protection orders and how they are working, but they are not being consistently applied.
Representative Greenman, do you have anything relevant to the fraud question? Because we'd like to get other members to start asking questions. This is not a hearing on gun control.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, my question was for you, because it isn't a hearing on banning these weapons of war. It also is not a hearing on fraud. And so when we talked about two prosecutions. We could talk about the Fleet Farm prosecution of straw purchasers and guns that are illegally sold in our communities. What I'm asking for you is when we think about the issues that this committee covers, right, we talk about fraud and government oversight, and this committee hearing is a good example of when we look at places where government oversight we want to take a closer look at. So my question for you is, can we have a hearing where we talk about the government oversight of our red flag laws, of our straw purchasers? Is that something that we can put on the agenda? Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Greenman. I'm open to hearings on any topic. I would say that that's more the jurisdiction of the Public Safety Committee, and I really want to get to the questions at hand. So I appreciate your comments.
Madam Chair,
thank you. One final thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I think this is the jurisdiction of the Elections and Local Government Committee. So I know this committee does a lot of things that are the jurisdiction of human services, of elections. What I think we're doing here is highlighting the places where where the public has asked us to look deeper. And I will say that I think the issue of gun violence prevention, which our leaders are talking about, which 60% of Minnesotans want us to cover, is something that we should be doing in this committee that looks at the jurisdiction of lots of committees.
Thank you. So I would like to start off the questioning with just a couple of my own. So first of all, from the press reports, one of the defendants admitted to getting 500 fake voter registrations. We don't have a number on the second one. This is the first time I've heard that there were 13 counties involved. I've seen press reports ranging from, 10 to 15. So having that clarification is helpful. But you talk about how no one voted. And I'd like you to try to back out of the numbers. No, saying 500 is conservative because we don't know what the other person submitted. So 500 fake registrations is conservative. But if that was indeed the floor, how do we know how many were actually created voter records in the system, how many were challenged, how many were inactivated, and help me back out how you know no one voted. If some of them remained in the system as challenged, and then the person went in to vote and presented the ID as we've gone over, they could have voted. So I want to understand how you know none of those fake registrations were actually votes cast. Thank you.
Madam Chair, I'm happy to field that question. So as part of that outreach to the 87 counties, that's where it was identified that 13 counties had flagged they had voter registration applications that fit this profile. Information was then compiled so that all of the records, whether they were ever entered into the statewide voter registration system or not, were tracked to determine and provided to the FBI so that they had the full list of all of those that had been identified.
And can you tell me the number? Was it higher than 500? What was the number?
Yes, it was higher than 500, but less than 600. So it was pretty close to what was named in the statement there.
Go ahead.
So within those records then, following the election, review was conducted to determine whether any of those records had cast a ballot. So we went through every single record that was identified by the counties and tracked whether its status and confirming its status was either not entered into the system or that it had been entered and challenged, and whether or not there had been any voting history associated with that record. So that's that process that I touched on, where after each election, the polling place roster's absentee voting history is applied to every single voter record. And as part of that review, none of the identified records had either cast or requested a ballot.
Thank you. My understanding is that this organization had multiple independent contractors. So two were caught. Do you know what other ballots were submitted for voter registration from this organization and how many that was?
Madam Chair, our office or the county elections offices would not necessarily track voter registration applications as being received from a particular organization. Most commonly, those are submitted by mail. So if there are voter registration applications, it's not identified as to the source from where they came from.
So once this was identified that this was going on and you knew they all came from this group, you didn't track other submissions of voter registrations from this group?
Madam Chair, so the subsequent batch that was identified in November of 2022 is ultimately what led to that referral to the FBI, and that those five counties that were identified is what created that link to those registrations and tracing that back to the organization. So to the extent that that was being tracked, that was in part how those were identified.
Thank you. Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First, Secretary Simon, I would just like to take the opportunity to publicly thank you for what you mentioned earlier, which was coming out to my district and sitting with kids in high school and talking about pre-registration and the importance of voting. I think that was a very enriching experience for them, and it was something that I personally enjoyed. So thank you for that. May sound like an odd way to start, but my house has never been broken into. It's never happened. But I still lock the doors at night. I still close the windows. I still take many other steps to minimize vulnerabilities. So it always strikes me when we have these conversations about election integrity that we tend to reduce it to the question of, is there fraud and how much is there? And that's a fascinating debate that we can go back and forth on. But I think the more important question is, where are the vulnerabilities in the system? So I'm going to paint a little hypothetical here and tell me where I'm wrong. It occurs to me that if this couple had been just a little bit smarter, a little less sloppy, they could have taken this same fabricated information and merely gone the day of, rather than trying to submit voter registration applications, and had people vouch for each other, use the fabricated information on the same day registration. And maybe that gets flagged down the road, but in the meantime, they're handed a ballot and they cast it. And once it's cast, it counts. Where am I wrong?
Mr. Linnell, or Secretary.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative. First of all, you're completely right in drawing the hypothetical that you draw in terms of, or not the hypothetical, but your premise, which is you got to protect the house every way that you reasonably can, even if you've never been burglarized, even if you've never been robbed. I completely agree with that. We can't just rest on our laurels, regardless of what the statistics are. I would say, not to get too weedy here, and I'll defer to Mr. Linnell on the weeds or any other context he wishes to provide, but when it comes to same day, I just respectfully disagree with the premise here, only in this sense. When you register to vote, same day or otherwise, you have to basically show two things. You are who you say you are, and you live where you say you live. That's it. Voter registration just means those two things, not 20 things, not 8 things, not 3 things, just those two. And vouching, and again, there are reasonable minds in this room can disagree about vouching. You can only vouch for 8 people, by the way, under the Minnesota state law. But vouching only gets at the live where you say you live part, not the you are who you say you are part. So even if they had someone who hadn't vouched for seven other people, eight other people, there would be that limitation. I get what you're saying, though, about, I don't want to get lost too much in the weeds. You're saying, hey, is there some way by which, whether the way that you described or some other way, they were just one or two steps on the cleverness meter away from succeeding, whether it was the way you described precisely or not. I guess I would say that, you know, certainly anything's possible in any system, an election system or anything else. I think the track record in Minnesota is really good. And I would say this, too, and I'll defer to Mr. Linnell on the specifics. My view is this, that any one of us in this room, if we were to redesign the Minnesota election system, let's say we started from scratch, we chucked out the window every single law and regulation, and we started over as to every single detail, I think in the back of our minds what we'd all be thinking about, we might not name it this way, but in the back of our minds we'd be thinking, what is the perfect intersection of access and security? Right? We all want access. I think everyone in this room does. No one wants it to be an unnecessary obstacle course. And I think everyone in this room wants security. You want only eligible voters and no one else voting. But I think no two people in this room, elected or unelected, would plot that on a graph at the exact same space. Your version of the perfect sweet spot of the intersection between access and security would be different from Madam Chair's, would be different from Representative Pinto's or anyone else in this room. And so I guess, generally speaking, I would say you always have to stay one step ahead of the bad guys. That's for sure. We always want to do that. I think this case from June is an example of the counties, first and foremost. I want to give them the credit. Did do that. We have a bottom-up system in Minnesota, not a top-down system, and they really did the right thing there. But overall, I would say, you know, there are a lot of hypotheticals, of course, but I think over the last 50 or so years in Minnesota, we've gotten to a really reliable and effective blend of access and security. But do you want to talk about that hypothetical or an adjacent hypothetical, Mr. Linnell?
Thank you, Secretary.
Mr. Linnell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think what I would add on that particular scenario in terms of being able to coordinate that type of operation, but also what it would require for the persons who are vouching, it's important to note that that's not just a slip of paper that they're signing. It's a legally binding oath that they are attesting to the fact that that individual is a resident of that precinct. And that person who's vouching does have to be a registered Minnesota voter. So there's identifying information for that voucher that's provided. And then as part of that post-election data entry process, if there's any issues with the eligibility of a voter, if that verification process were to fail for someone who had vouched for, that information would be handed over to the county attorney's office, and I would imagine would be facing an outcome similar to what these two are facing on these charges.
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So just to review, so you're saying that the vouching process, you still have to prove that you are who you say you are, which you would do with an ID.
Yes.
And then the vouching is that you live where you say you live.
Right.
So going back to Patty Anderson's scenario, Representative Anderson, mm-hmm. My apologies.
That's all right.
You could have somebody who is not a U.S. citizen who presents their driver's license that they can now receive here in the state of Minnesota. Somebody vouches that they live where they say they live. They get to cast a ballot. And let's say it gets flagged down the line, gets referred to a county attorney, results in a prosecution. They perjured themselves. Great. But the ballot that they cast still counted, correct?
Madam Chair and Representative Hudson, you know, when someone is falsifying that document to be able to register and or sign the roster and vote, they're provided with a ballot. It's presumed that the oath that they are signing off, that they are an eligible voter. So they would be faced with those penalties if it's determined that they were not eligible at the time, but there's no way of going backwards to identify that ballot that was cast.
Last question, Representative Hudson, for now.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Different topic. So when you were talking about this ERIC system, you stated, if I recall correctly, that when ERIC detects a requirement for a status change, death, duplicate, whatever the case may be, that the information goes to the appropriate county so that the record can be updated.
What does the update mean? Are we talking about deleting records, or are we talking about switching them to an inactive status, which then could potentially be a registration once again?
Mr. Linnell.
Madam Chair, Representative Hudson, the action that would be taken after a match is confirmed would be dependent on the type of report data that's being provided. So in the instance of a match to the Social Security Death Master file, the record would be marked as deceased. So it would be deceased in the system. It would not be on the voter rolls. If it suggests that they have applied for a driver's license in another state, that would trigger that process to ultimately inactivate the record. It would first mail out to them a notice and provide them a 21-day window to contact the county and say, hey, I'm actually not moving. There was an error here. I maintain my residence in Minnesota. So each of the updates that are a result of the reports that we received back from Eric trigger a designated action that the county would take upon the review of those records.
Thank you. Representative Anderson.
Thank you. I have two questions. One is a follow-up. So someone has gone in, whether they register in advance or they go in the same day, they have their driver's license, which again, Minnesota, anybody can have a driver's license. It doesn't say not a citizen on it if you're not a citizen. They vote, but if no one challenges it, do we go back after the fact and compare it to records of whether you're actually a citizen of the U.S.?
Mr. Linnell.
Madam Chair, one of the reports that we do have, which is from the Department of Public Safety, is the list of persons that are here on a temporary visa. So that report that comes through monthly does help to identify anyone who may not be eligible to vote for citizenship purposes and flags that for the county to review and refer for investigation. That's probably the primary tool at our disposal to be able to review citizenship information. There's not a state level or federal level database to run against for citizenship purposes that state law authorizes and that exists.
Thank you. But if they're here illegally, they wouldn't be on that list then, and they wouldn't be flagged. Is that correct?
Mr. Leno.
Madam Chair, Representative, the list that we receive is specific to those who are here on a temporary visa. That's what is outlined in statute and the data that DPS has to provide to us on a monthly basis.
Okay, thank you. I have a slightly unrelated to this line. One final question. What sort of checks do you do on the county? The counties sort of hold that and are supposed to clean up the voter rolls if the county. What checks do you do? We know that when there was the recount in Scott County, you know, the Tabke seat last year, and going through the voter roll, we know there were a bunch of people on that list that they didn't vote, but they were deceased, and some were deceased, you know, several years. So they were obviously not taken off in that six-month schedule that you know, talked about, that you look at health records. So what do we do to make sure that people that are deceased actually, I mean, do we double check the work of the county auditors? So thank you.
Mr. Linnell.
Madam Chair, Representative, we at the state level, we do have access to a sort of central dashboard that shows the number of reports or applications that are set in the county queues for processing to ensure that those are being handled and processed in a timely manner. I'll also note, I guess, going back to the 2018 Office of the Legislative Auditor report, as well as the current process that the OLA is undertaking to conduct a review of voter registration in Minnesota, and how they assessed the work that was being done both at the state level and the county level in that first report, and are evaluating at the current time to ensure that all of us are complying with the laws and procedures that keep our records up to date, and to identify any potential issues there. So I think that will be a good insight into that process. But we maintain regular ongoing communication with county elections offices, outreach to ensure that especially new county auditors have the information, resources, tools, and training they need to be successful at their jobs. The last several years have seen an exceptional rate of turnover in county election positions, and so the need to provide and equip new folks with that information has been a priority for the office and will continue to be moving into the future.
Thank you. Thank you.
Lead Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you so much, Mr. Secretary, and to your team. And I guess I want to echo the thanks of the Department of Justice, both to your office and also should acknowledge the Carver County Sheriff's Office. Sounds like they really kicked things off and so good that they were paying attention to the to things. I guess two things, maybe Mr. Linnell, perhaps Secretary Simon, you know, the motivation of these people who were participating in this scheme, it seems like the motivation was to make money as easy as possible, that they were not, that their motivation in this particular case, and it doesn't undermine any other points that were made, but in this particular case, do we have a sense of that, either Secretary Simon or Mr. Linnell?
Secretary.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Pinto. That's certainly the sense that I got. I think it was publicly reported that that was the sense of the Justice Department, too. Obviously, there was no trial here. They pled out, and so we'll maybe never know with specificity, but that seems to have been the angle here, yes.
Okay. And then?
Lead Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then the other thing is just, Mr. Secretary, I guess I wanted to ask you to expand a little bit. You talked about the balance between, I think you said security and access, and as an elections expert yourself, I think those terms sort of, there's a lot packed into those two terms. When I think about it, I think about, you know, balancing this, there's a fundamental point that we want to ensure that only eligible people are participating in this fundamental exercise of our democracy, which I guess I would sort of define as on the security side, and that we're not overburdening what is a fundamental right, which is the right to vote when you are in fact an eligible voter. And I guess before I go to you, I'll just say when I think about the burglary metaphor, which I think is such a good one, thinking about like in this case, these folks got there was this false form that was submitted. It's sort of like needing that to get on your lawn, you know, before they got close to the house. There's a whole series of checks that happened to go into place. And we really are balancing in so many areas fundamental rights and wanting to protect them in various ways. We do that with the First Amendment. We do that with the Second Amendment, the reference to that, and with voting as well. I've spent time, happened to spend some time in Latin America the last couple of years and a couple of short trips, and noticed like there, almost every home, in fact, has high walls and even like pieces like glass that's actually attached to the top of the walls to ensure people don't climb over. We don't do that in the U.S. And yet, if you want to be absolutely certain, right, you could have a whole series of walls and moats and a whole bunch of things. You also want to be able to get in and out of your house. So if you could just, Mr. Secretary, just expand on as we're trying to balance this in our system, if you could.
Secretary Simon.
Madam Chair, Representative Pinto, I'm not sure I could say it any better. It does come down to that balance. It's access and security. I think everyone here wants that balance, but defines the perfect sweet spot in a different way. And you're right. We always have to be careful about making something maybe too accessible or making something subject to too many security features. And we're always looking for that sweet spot. And again, there are as many, you know, sweet spots as there are people. No two people would plot it in the same place. But I think you're right, and that's what all of us, I think, have in the back of our minds. What is that sweet spot? They will vary widely in this room and in the general public. There's no question. But I think we're all on the same page about those two things. To use your analogy, borrowing from Representative Hudson's analogy, I would say in this particular case, they didn't really, arguably didn't even really get to the house. I think this is an example of the counties in the first instance flagging and catching something with our assist later, working with the FBI, and this actually had a happy ending, I think. So that's what I'd say generally about the balance, but I don't know, Mr. Linnell, if you have anything to add to that.
Mr. Linnell.
Mr. Secretary, thank you, Madam Chair. I think that's exactly right, and I think some of the advancements that have been made, including membership in ERIC, including online voter registration, all of these things help to get that verification step done on the front end and then make sure that we're constantly updating and maintaining our roles. And I think Minnesota is out in front on this and does a really robust job of ensuring that our voter rolls are up to date and remain up to date throughout the calendar year and the election cycle.
And then final comment, if I can. I'll be brief.
Yes, thank you, Lead Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so thank you so much. And so when I think about the statistic of there having been so few incidents in all these years, I don't view that as saying, oh, we leave the house unlocked and all the windows and doors open, but more just to say that the system that we have, in fact, is doing a very good job, that this is a success in this instance, and that there are so few that we can say, hey, the system is doing a very good job of preventing people from doing the wrong thing, while as we're trying to balance out as well, being sure that this fundamental right can be exercised. So we don't let up at all, but I think we can feel good about the system we have. And to my mind, that's what the two votes in, you know, since 1979 statistic, which remember, there's a requirement that elections officials have to flag if there's something concerning. County attorneys have to go after it, et cetera. And people do end up going to prison. So it's working very well. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Did you have a comment? Because I have a couple more questions. Okay.
I did. Thank you, Madam
Secretary
Chair.
Simon.
I just wanted to flag, since you flagged it, Representative Pinto, a lot of people in the public don't know, we have a statute quite strict that I support on the books that requires that if a citizen, any citizen, makes, flags a particular allegation of voter misconduct and does so by affidavit, so it can't just be a phone call or an anonymous note. If by affidavit you say, I saw something, I heard something, I detected something, that law enforcement must investigate it. There is zero discretion. That is an extraordinary statute. I've talked about that recently with some people who had concerns and think they saw something or witnessed something with respect to one of the municipal elections going on. I just had this conversation. I don't think a lot of people know about that, so I always take the opportunity. If you see something and you can swear to it that you saw something in an affidavit, it must be investigated. That's a standard we don't even have for violent crimes. And I support that. I'm glad we have that in law. If it's elections related and you make that claim by affidavit, it must be investigated by law enforcement. No ifs, ands, or buts, no exceptions.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. So I just want to go back to a couple things. First of all, we determined that there was between 500 and 600 of these fake registrations, and that some of them were never entered as records, but some were in the system as challenged.
Right.
How many were in the system as challenged, and are they still in the system as challenged? Mr. Linnell.
Madam Chair, yeah, we can confirm that all of the records that were confirmed to have been fraudulently submitted have been inactivated in the system, so do not appear.
So they're listed as inactivated. So if someone showed up, they could go through the process of an inactive where they have to show proof of ID and still vote. How many of those are inactivated in the system right now?
Madam Chair, just to make the distinction between an inactive voter record would not appear on the voter rolls at all. It is an incomplete registration that would be one that has been challenged and be required to show ID at the polling place before they were able to cast a ballot. I do not have the numbers before me of those that might be in that status at this time.
Great. I would love to know that if you could follow up with me. Secondly, as Chair Pinto alluded to, we are paying people to register voters, and clearly that was a huge incentive for more than 500 fake voter registrations. Do you support paying for voter registration, Mr. Secretary?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm glad you flagged that, because we have a law that you passed a couple years ago, and thank you for that, that makes it illegal to pay by the registration. You can pay someone for their labor, just like any job, by the hour, but you cannot pay anyone per voter registration. Now, we don't know yet, because the FBI may have an ongoing investigation, whether they're investigating the payor. So far, two payees have gotten in trouble, and they pled to felony counts and will be sentenced, as you heard. But as to the payor, we don't know the status of the FBI investigation. That is illegal. You clarified that, I think, 2 years ago, and we appreciate that, and I support that. And in fact, I think we either testified or submitted a letter in favor of that. So it is illegal, I want to make clear, to pay by the voter registration in Minnesota.
Which I appreciate. And we are still trying to understand if these people, as news reports flagged, they admitted in some instances that they were paid by the voter registration. So that brings me to the point of this foundation. Clearly, they hired people as independent contractors. Two of them were found guilty. This group, I've done a deep dive on their 990s, 99% of their budget comes from state grants. So this is a group that the state is funding and that then went out and did these voter registrations and has has, you know, they participated. The foundation didn't participate in fraud, but they hired people with state dollars who then used that to create fake voter registrations. Does it concern you that 99% of a group's focus is from state dollars? And what should we do to provide oversight of nonprofits that engage in voter registration activities if the bulk of their budget is from the state?
Madam Chair, it does concern me. And I assume that you or some other body will look into that. I just want to clarify for the record, not from us. We don't give any grants. We don't give one penny to any for-profit, nonprofit. The only grants we ever give are grants that you tell us to give to local governments for things like elections equipment or accessibility grants, but that's it. So just to clarify for the record, not from us. I don't know who they got their money from, but sure, I think that's worthy of discussion and oversight. I leave to you. I wouldn't presume to tell you how to exercise that oversight, but sure, I think if anything that's receiving state money is doing something that's against the law, that should be looked into, whether it's 99% or 1%.
Thank you. My next question is related to the ERIC system. So we participate with 25 other states in the ERIC system sharing all this voter data, yet you continue to not want to share the same data with the federal government. Could you explain the difference between sharing it with the feds and sharing it with ERIC?
Yes, I can. Thank you for the question. So as you heard, there are elaborate ways that that information is shielded, that it can never be traced to a person when we share it with ERIC. According to the bylaws and the rules of ERIC, blessed by this legislature, by the way, as you heard, that is so-called hashed data. And I rely on experts to describe exactly what that means, but it can never be traced to an actual individual. By contrast, what the Department of Justice has asked for is very private data on millions of Minnesotans, Social Security numbers, driver's license information, in some cases military-related information. And as to the DOJ lawsuit, if I may, Madam Chair, you know, this is a great example of something that belongs in court. There's no shame or harm. Sometimes we see headlines about Party A sues Party B or X sued Y, and there's no need for any shame or blame attached to that. The very reason we have courts is to settle a legal dispute, and here we have one. The Department of Justice has asked us and many other states for that information. Most states, including red and blue states, have said the same as us, that we don't think, as a matter of law, they are legally entitled under these circumstances to that data. If they were here, they would vigorously disagree with that position. They'd say we were out to lunch and we were wrong on the law. But that's exactly why we have courts. We don't duke it out in the streets. We go to a court. A judge will decide whose legal position is right. And, of course, we will abide by whatever the courts say.
Thank you. And just to be clear, you do provide the Social Security data and the driver's license data through this hashed, you know, very secure system, but you're still providing that data in the ERIC system, correct?
Yeah, in a way that's untraceable to any individual.
And so we couldn't use a similar system to provide that to the feds?
No, Madam Chair, no, because they don't want that. They want it tied to individuals. They want it produced in its native form where you know the person's Social Security number, you know the person's driver's license information.
Thank you. So I just want to go on to another question about the challenge status. In the OLA report in 2018, she identified that there had been 26,000 ballots that were of the challenge status. And I went back in the HAVA list that's available online to anyone who wants to look at it. And in 2024, we had 6,000 that were non-matches, 6,800, 1,300 in 2022, 3,000 in 2021, 8,000 in 2021, I'm sorry, 23,000 in 20, 16,000 in 2018. So I have the list. And all of these go as non-matches, which I assume then become challenged. And so are they still in the system as challenged? And if so, I know after 4 years they go inactive, but otherwise they just, all these things that aren't matched by DPS or Social Security, they just live in the system as challenged and anyone can still vote as long as they provide the ID or the vouching, et cetera. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, to take a step back, I think. So with the data that you're citing from the HAV matching process, I think it's important to point out that that does not in and of itself mean that there's not, it's not a verified individual who's submitting that application. The numbers actually point to that SSA matching process being a really rigid, exact matching requirement. So to the hyphenated names, to the data entry issues, those are really what kick out a lot of those flagged returns as not matching with data in the SSA database. Once that data is returned, there's an opportunity for the county to review that record. So it will provide in a queue with a 10-day time frame to go back, look at the voter registration application, determine whether or not there may have been something that was, you know, not clear on the form that was entered incorrectly, to follow up with the voter. So those are those contacts with the voter, phone call, email, mail, to get additional information and ultimately get the majority of those cases to be verified through that process, whether it's updating the voter registration with the correct number or it's clarifying whether they may have a different name to be able to match against the Social Security Administration database, or for the auditor to verify that, yes, this is a person for whom I've been able to confirm their identity. So that impacts, I think, and reflects how the process works for a majority of those records that come back returned from the SSA matching process. But to the number of challenged voters that are cited in the OLA report, I think in most of those cases, those challenges would relate to the second half of the matching process, that you live where you say you live, and challenge for a returned postal verification card. And there are a number of reasons for why those cards may be returned, and I think the legislative report that's submitted each year helps to illuminate why some of those cards may come back for perfectly innocuous reasons, whether, you know, someone may be temporarily away or they don't have their mailbox up at the time. So those are things that the county would then look into if it shows that that voter who was challenged for an address issue had been voted at the election, and determine whether or not they were in fact eligible to vote.
Great, thank you. And I had one more follow-up. So we talked a lot about the citizenship issue. And now that Minnesota provides driver's licenses to anyone, how do you verify that people who are not citizens and not here on a visa don't get into the system? So is there a back-end communication with DPS about who's not a citizen but also not on a visa, or are those just allowed through?
Madam Chair, I can speak to the process through those who are applying for a driver's license at DPS. In 2023, the legislature did pass automatic voter registration that's now in effect, which requires that an individual applying for their driver's license must provide citizenship-affirming documentation in order to be sent over to our office for review and registration purposes. So that the timing for that has meant that the records that are provided are only those who have proactively provided to DPS that citizenship-affirming documentation. I think we talked through some of the other hypothetical scenarios. If someone is registering to vote on Election Day and is filling out a paper voter registration and attesting that they're eligible to vote, whether they have a driver's license or not, if they're not, in fact, eligible, those are cases where it's then incumbent on the review process to identify if that person may not be eligible to vote. I know one example from a county that we were just in touch with cited media reports referencing someone who had been who was not an American citizen and flagged for them to look into that voter record that had just come through their office. From the time the media report to the time that they got that application, they had naturalized and become a U.S. citizen. So there are triggers for that that might cause a county to take a look and review and investigate whether there may be an issue of someone's eligibility, whether it be citizenship or for any other reason why they may not be eligible to vote.
So you're saying, just to be clear, that if they get a driver's license and do not provide proof of citizenship, it doesn't actually go to your office?
Madam Chair, that's correct. Yeah, since automatic voter registration was established in 2023 and then certified and started last year, the only records that come through for voter registration purposes are those who have provided citizenship-affirming documentation, such as a passport or U.S. birth certificate, to the driver and vehicle services at the time of that transaction.
And if they have citizenship-affirming documentation, a passport, a birth certificate, you said, is there a way they can affirm citizenship just based on attestation?
I'm sorry.
So could someone provide, like, they submit these documents, they say, you know, here's my birth certificate, I was born in, you know, St. Paul, blah, blah, blah. Are those verified before the system kicks them to you?
Madam Chair, yes. That is how the process is designed. It's actually a two-step verification process, both at the time of transaction and then a secondary review by Department of Public Safety staff to affirm that this document that was provided is, in fact, a citizenship-affirming document. So it is there for a visual review. It's not an attestation that takes place as part of that driver's license or ID application.
Great. Thank you very much. Mr. Secretary, I was about to interrupt you. Did you have thoughts you wanted to share?
I think he covered it.
Okay, great. And then just one last thing for me. So you talked about how when we register to vote, you have to prove who you are and prove where you live. I think those are very good common sense. But you do not have to prove citizenship. That part is attestation. Would you support having proof of citizenship as part of the way we verify eligibility in Minnesota versus just attestation?
Well, I'll answer that, thank you, Madam Chair, in a couple ways. This has been proposed by the President and proposed by Congress. It's called the SAVE Act in Congress, which would provide documentary proof of citizenship. You have to attest to it right now, but documentary proof of citizenship. And going back to the earlier analogy that we all want the perfect intersection of access and security, from where I sit, there are real problems with that requirement. For example, we have 69 million American women who have a different last name now than when they were born. So in order to show documents, documentary proof of citizenship, a woman with a last name now that's different from birth would have to, if they didn't have a U.S. passport, and that includes north of 20 million American women, they would have to show two documents, a birth certificate and a marriage record. And that's only if they've been married once. If it's twice, you'd have to follow the chain and have two marriage records. I just want everyone to understand what that means, practically speaking. You can't just take someone's word for it. If we're going away from attestation and someone says, well, this is my birth certificate, my name is Jones now, but it was Smith, if attestation is no good for proof of citizenship, then it ought not to be good for that purpose either. So I just want to everyone to understand what the burdens are of imposing that kind of system. Now, there is one state in particular that's worth noting. Kansas, about 15 years ago, did a state-level SAVE Act where they required proof of citizenship for registration to vote. And before it was struck down by a federal court, 30,000 eligible Kansas voters, eligible as you are or I am, were turned away because they couldn't produce the proper proofs. I don't think we want to be that in Minnesota. So that's why I oppose that.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. And I agree. We want to very carefully balance access and safeguards. And I think that in general, Minnesota has and does do a good job on that. But I think it's concerning to a lot of citizens that people who are not eligible to vote may, in fact, take advantage of that. And as a married woman, you have to do the same thing when you get your driver's license and you get your new name. It's just part of the process. So I've always thought that was interesting as an argument for that being a burden. I think most people who are married and change their names of either sex, because people change their name either direction, have not found that burdensome in terms of getting a driver's license. So I think I'm not sure that that's as relevant. So we appreciate your time. I have so many more questions, but I'm going to go to Representative Greenman quickly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I appreciate this conversation. Just to follow up, housekeeping question. Can you provide those 990s that you were referring to?
I'm not Absolutely. Sure
if, thank you. Can you all share and Secretary Simon, what with as we talk about the federal request for that data, did they share how they're planning on combining it with other data? That has been a huge concern that I've heard from my constituents, as we have heard about DOGE and Social Security data and a whole set of other data. Do we have information about if they get this data, what they plan on doing with it?
Secretary Simon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, this gets to our fundamental legal position in the lawsuit, and this starts and ends with the law from our standpoint. So our read of the law, federal and state law, is that in order for us to be authorized legally to share this, not just with the Department of Justice, but with any federal agency, they have to do at least two things. One, they have to show with particularity why they need the data, not generally, but specifically why this particular data. And number two, they have to show what they're going to do with the data. Those are two very different things. Are they going to share it, sell it, transmit it? How are they going to store it? That sort of thing. And our legal position is that they've done neither of those things. And I will point out that our legal position is shared by multiple secretaries of state, not just the eight states, including Minnesota, that have been sued so far, but by secretaries of state, I shouldn't name them, who of both political parties who have not been sued yet. I suspect they will be because they're taking the same legal position we have. So, no, the short answer is we don't believe they've met either of those requirements, including the requirement of who they're going to give it to. There was some independent reporting about 3 weeks ago, maybe 4 weeks ago now, that the Department of Homeland Security wants to get its hands on this data that the Department of Justice is seeking from the states for certain alleged purposes. We'll see. You know, we'll hash all this out in court. But again, this is a perfect dispute that belongs in court because we just have a fundamentally different read of the applicable laws.
Thank
you. Representative Greenman.
Thank you. Just a quick statement. I really appreciate that. The privacy of voter data, we know that in these, in your records and in the voter records are people's social security numbers and very private things. We have heard as it relates to IRS data, as it relates to voting data, as it relates to a lot of the data, there's a federal privacy law and there's a lot of reasons why those laws have not been compiled into a mass database over the set of 50 years. The federal government having that has been a concern, not just on the left, but on the right too. So really appreciate you standing up for the privacy and the protections of Minnesota voters. I know that there's lots of other secretary of states are too, but for Minnesota, for the 3 million Minnesota voters, thank you for doing that.
Lead Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a request. Earlier in the hearing, you'd referenced an organization and a 990 and certain percentages. Just wondering if you could get a copy to committee members after of what you were referencing. I was a little confused and appreciate that. Thank you.
Happy to do that. Thank you, members. I just want to follow up. In the OLA report, the 2018, the OLA recommended that the counties use the reports in the SVRS. And I'd like to understand the status of that. Are you now kicking out those reports and requiring, it was recommended the counties use them. Is it now required that the counties use them?
Madam Chair, in response to that finding from the OLA report in 2018, I think there were some recommendations to make some updates to certain reports to make them, I think, more accessible, make the data more usable in those reports. Those changes were made in short order after the report was issued. And then as a process for guidance that we provide to counties, both on the eve of elections as part of the roster generation steps, and then in the post-election period when they begin to enter voter registrations, enter voting history, that finding is cited in our guidance to counties every election cycle to affirm that this is a report that you need to run to follow up on the data that might show someone's status as updated due to voting and to review any discrepancies that might be found in that report. So the report does provide all of the information that was recommended by the OLA to have that at the county's disposal to review those records.
So she did say not all county officials use the SVRS report designed to identify voting by ineligible persons. We recommend they use the report, but clearly it's still not a requirement that they use the report. Is that what you're saying?
Madam Chair, as far as what the law may require for them to run, I think it's more broadly under their role and responsibility to investigate potential issues or voter anomalies. And so I think it would fall under that, our guidance. It's not a legal requirement to say this is a specific report you must run each election, but it's reflected in our detailed guidance to counties about the steps they need to follow as part of their post-election data entry and review.
Thank you. And the last question, the state law requires that county attorneys investigate and prosecute the voter registration fraud. 13 counties, by testimony today, were notified of voter registration fraud, yet none prosecuted. Can you explain to me why the county prosecutors, as required under statute, didn't take these cases and why it went to the feds?
Madam Chair, I'll take a stab at that one. Not knowing the individual decision-making tree in the 13 counties, I do know that it's somewhat common for counties to defer to federal law enforcement when the feds get involved. We have a prosecutor now nodding his head with Representative Pinto, but that's not uncommon, and I think that would be in keeping with the Minnesota law, I would suspect, but maybe someone from the County Attorneys Association can better answer that question. I know I've seen it, though, quite often. Not just in the election sphere, but in other spheres as well.
Did they decline to prosecute?
Madam Chair, I have no idea. I have no idea what the county attorneys are thinking or what their decision process was, but it's not uncommon for them to have some sort of agreement with the federal government that the feds will basically take the lead in a particular case.
Thank you. I'm going to defer to my colleague, Chair Pinto.
Madam Chair, and I do work as an assistant county attorney and prosecutor. I'm looking at Minnesota Statute 201.275, which is the one that's referenced here that requires, as the Secretary has said, that the investigation occur and that requires prosecution. It does say, quote, it says, if there is probable cause for instituting a prosecution, the county attorney shall proceed according to the generally applicable standards regarding the prosecutorial functions and duties of a county attorney, which certainly would include not pursuing a prosecution if, in fact, there's going to be a federal prosecution. Somebody very often will get a longer prison sentence, et cetera. So I do not read this statute as saying that the county attorney must bring forth what would end up being a wasteful and, in fact, possibly interfere with a federal prosecution. So I suspect that's the answer. But, again, the County Attorney's Association, Secretary said, could provide an official comment on it. Thanks.
Thank you. Well, members, thank you very much for a robust hearing on all these matters. We appreciate the work of the Secretary and your team for making elections accessible and safe. And we want to all continue to also thank our federal partners for their prosecution of these cases. 500 fake voter registration applications in Minnesota was discouraging, to say the least, but we're grateful that has been prosecuted. Thank you. We are adjourned.
Thank you.